All right, guys, welcome to another episode of Storytime with Tofu. Running a little low on space in the cloud for these podcasts. I need to figure out how to deal with that. So we're probably, as you've noticed, we're going to definitely try to keep it to one episode a week. I might try and do two if I can get a guest on. I'm still trying to get Nate to talk about Fargo with me. It's not at all his fault, it's mine. I've just been stupid and unorganized. And again, my friend Joey called me out on it. But again, I have just been bogged down with scheduling, so I do indeed apologize. However, that being bogged down with scheduling has not gotten in the way of my wonderful and thoughtful reporting of television. But so let's get right into that. So as usual, the fall brings wonderful gifts of new television, and the most recent package was delivered in the form of I believe a series of 8 Amazon pilots. I only watched 2 of them, so I still need to finish that, but one of them was If You Give a Mouse a Cookie. So if, you know, you feel like being nostalgic or want to get really high and watch something really simple that'll make you laugh, you could put that on, you know, or a myriad of other things, because, you know, hashtag 2015, hashtag Netflix and chill. But anyway, back to Amazon. They released a pilot called Good Girls Revolt, and again, it's just the pilot, so don't let me get your hopes up and tell you to watch this and get so excited and then really pissed off you can't binge watch an entire series of it. No, I'm telling you to watch Good Girls Revolt not only because it's interesting, well done, and incredibly topical. I'm telling you to watch it because it needs to get made still. I want to see 12 episodes or 10 to 12 episodes of this show being made, and you need to vote for it. If you don't have Amazon Prime, or you tell me that, you are lying to me. You are lying to me, or are you in self-denial about the reality and the living of today? Okay? I can get a brief segue. When I was living in New York, we were having a party the next day, and it was about 8 p.m. on a Friday. And we realized the speaker we ordered, we didn't get the right converter for it. And yes, we could have probably gone around and found one in New York. But the main thing was we were kind of drunk when we made this realization. So we ended up Amazon Priming it and it, you know, do the one day delivery. And it somehow miraculously came at 9 a.m., less than 12 hours the next day. So I guess I'm not sponsored by Amazon Prime. But as a frequent patron of it, especially as someone, if you're as lazy as me, or you know what, you're not as lazy as me, you work so hard, unlike me, during your day, you really would like those little extra conveniences at the end of your day with no extra cost to yourself, you just get Amazon Prime, okay? That was my spiel about that. We'll pretend we have a sponsor, but get Amazon Prime today. But anyway, if you have it, like you should, all of these series are free to watch. The only thing you technically have to pay for, like iTunes on Amazon Prime, are usually content added by networks. So for example, if I want to watch like You're the Worst on Amazon Prime, which is an FXX show, I have to pay for that. Or movies like you would on iTunes. But everything else that's all Amazon produced, and that doesn't necessarily mean Amazon main, it could mean Amazon, you know, it's just producing the program by distributing it, should be free to watch. So that includes Deutschland 83, which you should probably watch, a variety, not Casual, that's on Hulu, Catastrophe, which is also on Amazon Prime, really great show, and Transparent, I believe. I've only seen the pilot of that, but that came out last year, and you know what? It's not something you're going to want to watch at the end of every day, but if you want an interesting afternoon, you know, you just want an interesting viewing of something, definitely give that show a shot. But back to the topic at hand. Good Girls Revolt was absolutely fantastic. And when I first saw the poster for it, I was like, God help us, we're getting another ABC Family show. Because whoever designed that poster should die. It's friggin' terrible. It feels like the 90s ran into a wall. Like, it's just that obnoxious neon pink. I don't know. The point is, you look at that poster and you see like a shitty B-movie. What it actually is a poster for is a really thoughtful, well done, well, I can't call it a series yet. It's a great concept for a series. Really well done pilot. And Judging from both the costume designer and the production designer, I can kind of see where they wanted to do a poster like that, especially to give the show kind of a younger sheen since Amazon Prime is kind of in its fledgling state. But it's a lot deeper than what you would assume from that. If you want a great review of it, this is how I actually figured out to watch this series. BuzzFeed, long-form writer, and my former professor, Anne Helen Peterson, did a great review of it. She has a great lens for it, because she's not necessarily a period expert in terms of, you know, journalism, etc. But journalism is one of her focuses, and she knows the industry incredibly well. So if you want a great perspective, you want some great ideas implanted before you watch the pilot, or if you don't, you can read it after. Again, BuzzFeed, Anne Helen Peterson, Good Girls Revolt. You'll find the article. It'll come up instantly because this is hashtag 2015. But anyway, there's a lot to talk about in terms of a pilot like this. I'm not going to talk about too many negative things, not because there weren't any, but because there weren't so many and they weren't intentionally distracting from the series, so bad that they were distracting from the series that, in my mind at this time, they're not wholly relevant. Because honestly, I need to see more of it to, you know, see if it remains problematic. But without going into too many detail, the series is lensed around women working at News of the Week magazine in 1969. Now, I also had to Wikipedia this, so if you have to do this as well, no shame against this. I didn't realize the first major sexist complaint in the workplace was launched, you know, by a female journalist in the 1970 at Newsweek magazine. And I'm sure you're going to kill me because I'm sure there's several movies about this and I should know this, but I didn't and I'm sorry. And now I'm glad I'm watching the show and the show caused me to learn more about it. So we can all smile about that, I suppose. But anyway, Good Girls Revolt, I would loosely pitch it and describe it as Mad Men meets Almost Famous with a female lens. I think by the end of the series, Mad Men did an incredible job of... Well, no, they were doing that from the beginning, but, you know, more so they did give, despite, you know, the show arguably being lensed around, you know, Don Draper, it gave us an incredible cast of both male and female characters to just fall in love with, experience every day, every episode, and kind of watch progress through their lives. I'm sure at times, I arguably should go back and rewatch this series, but at times we are very lensed around, you know, Don Draper, around Betty in an episode. But, you know, it doesn't... The show lets you do a lot on your own. It lets you make your own assumptions, the wrong word. It lets you embrace the world at your own pace, at your own time, lets you discover what it has to offer again, discover what it has to offer on your own terms. It doesn't force you into a lot of corners. And again, this could be up for debate. I'd love to talk about it. Not saying that Good Girls Revolt does do that, but more so like you're watching... Kind of, or if the opposite spectrum of Mad Men is you're watching an episode of, like, NCIS or Law & Order, you feel a lot more manipulated into who you're supposed to, what you're supposed to think, who you're supposed to look at, and what message the overall program is sending. And what's great about Law & Order is it changes every episode because they have to change depending on the issue or who's feeling what at the time. But it's less immersive of a world. It's less immersive of a narrative in the sense that I hate saying things are being spoon-fed to you because that's going to come off like the show's doing things callously. It's not. But it definitely casts the halo around you that you should be focusing, in my opinion, on these three central women, Patty Robinson, Grace Gunner's character, who's, I believe her name is Nora, and I'm terrible with names. Erica Dark's character, I'm sorry, I looked up the actresses before the podcast, but I can't remember the character's name. But, and although we do get individual scenes of men in the office, men not in the office in their own world to get perspective. Force is the wrong word. It feels more intentional. And I don't see us setting into the character of the men in this show, and I won't go into it that much more, but my belief is that, you know, where I was like, oh, well, why is it about putting more, you know, I always hear the argument, why is it about putting more women in this? Why is it about putting more this and this? Like, what about the people that are already there doing this? Like, it's unfair to them. It's, you know, we need to focus on both things, not just reverse the argument to one. And you know what? I lied to myself, and okay, obviously not black and white situations I'm describing here, but I've lied to myself and believe that to very much be the case. Like, I've never in my way felt that a woman could not do a job just as well as men. But I've definitely told myself, well, but I believe that, so that's all that matters. Like, why do we need to bring it up? Why do we constantly need to talk about it? And luckily, as I've matured into, no, we'll not say adult yet. Luckily, as I've matured, I understand why we need to talk about it, why it needs to be brought up, why it's not okay. Just like, well, you know, I've never thought that way. Or because if you, I'm sorry, I won't go too much, but because if you don't engage with that type of subject matter, it dies. It loses its presence. It loses its impact, and it loses its ability to evolve. And it's not that if something isn't evolving, it's not, you know, progressing forward, it's not remaining relevant. It's that your discussion of it, your internal processing of it, has ceased to function. And that, to me, is what this show is illustrating perfectly. This pilot illustrated perfectly. And what I mean by that is, we experience Mad Men through the lens that, okay, this is the time where women are, okay, it's hard to say that because throughout all of history and throughout the past 60 years, that's still been the case. But if the Mad Men was a soft opening for a woman in the workplace, for a woman trying to become a professional, not having to deal with this whole, like, well, I have a husband, I have a family, that's my life. And, you know, the free love movement, and you have a younger, I don't want to say baby boomer, but yeah, kind of the baby boomer generation taking these younger roles in all of society. You see a complacency in the male characters of this world, in that, not that we're okay with the way things are, but again, this whole, and which is incredible because it's still happening today, the whole, like, well, this is what you have right now. It wasn't like this before, and you should be really grateful that you're in this position right now. And luckily, no one in my life has ever said that to me, for being Asian, for being, you know, male, for any purpose. But goddamn, would that be soul-crushing, upsetting, and infuriating if, you know, I was at a job, and I was doing my best, and I said, you know, things aren't going really, you know, progressing what I wanted. You know, all my other coworkers are getting put ahead of me, and I do twice the work and do it just as well as them. And why is that? It's like, well, we gave you this job. You know, you wouldn't have got this job a year ago. Well, why are you upset? You should be happy that you have this job. Like, even without the, like, shade of race, gender, anything, that is that is a horrifying thing to have to listen to. And so what I mean by a complacency and an easiness to forget, I can clearly see, you know, this is how culture changes. Like, this is why I feel like, you know, right as I got to college, there was a large move for progressive change, but it was definitely not nearly as outspoken as it is now. It is not as revealing as it is now. And I probably was one of those people who probably could have stopped talking about it a little and forgot that, you know, as we clearly are reminded today, these issues don't go away. The sediment don't go away. It doesn't matter how much you whitewash it. It doesn't matter how much you self-rationalize it. because if you're unattached to the issue, it can never be, you know, something prevalent in your daily discourse, which it kind of needs to be. But anyway, sorry about that. So as you can tell, the show's incredibly topical. But moving on from that, let's talk about what makes it entertaining and fun to watch. Why are these characters interesting? Why are they compelling? And more importantly, why is this not a droll, really long drama that's going to make me feel like Girls tried to do something, period? Well, first of all, Girls is a very different type of show, so I'll just keep it at that. Whereas this show doesn't heavily rely on the period to get its message across, Girls, in my opinion, can't function without that. And that's what makes it a good show. That's what makes it interesting. But again, this is not Girls. Although, AMC, take a note. I'm super pumped for Into the Badlands, but you need to do a show like Girls. But anyway, So Good Girls, what's great about it, and I mentioned this, and we'll leave Mad Men and talk about this in an Almost Famous type of vibe, is it instills, I'm sorry, I use the word instill a lot. I'm working on not repeating myself as much on these podcasts, guys. But the important thing is it wonder, fascination, kind of like slowly falling into a pool that is this time, world, and cultural idea. You know, I don't know my 70s music enough and 60s music enough to name all the songs, you know, directly, but every single musical choice made in this episode was so perfectly deliberate. And I know I talked about how the Nick doesn't use this type of music to drag you into the period. This does the opposite. It does, and it does so very well. The main character, again, Patty Robinson, played by Genevieve Angleson, she's a research assistant for a reporter. Her specialty is, you know, the music scene, and it takes place in New York, but she flies all the way to San Francisco to cover, you know, an important cultural event, which I'll talk about a little later in this episode, because I want to talk about just kind of overall why. Maybe I'll talk about it now. Okay. Sorry, guys. Rough podcast today. So basically, there's a huge concert in 1916. It's 1969. A huge concert outside of San Francisco. The series starts with that, and a man is stomped to death, and the whole conspiracy is, you know, the police are blaming the free love hippie movement when really it was because the band hired Hell's Angels as the bodyguards, and this whole notion that, like, we don't trust the police anymore. You know, again, I hate lensing things and going back to this topical. I just said we were going to move on from that. But, you know, that, again, that's a sentiment that's still there. It's like people don't trust the police. You know, I trust the police. Well, at least I thought I did. But, you know, a lot of people in this country still don't. And, you know, we don't. Not that, like, this show's hand-harding that and making it, you know, but it's interesting that they chose to lead open with that type of story. The other incredibly important thing, which is also still kind of parallel today, is, so this is actually an interaction between two male characters. I don't know if you guys watch Silicon Valley, but the douchey rich investor played by Chris Dianopoulos, he has a weird last name, but kind of looks like the goofy, more bro, like California bro-y version of the Punisher. he's the chairman, the head of this magazine. It's his magazine in this series, and he kind of represents what, in my opinion, are the young men in the Mad Men era. They're eager to join this older workforce, but have a few more progressive ideas, but are somewhat the bridge between old and new in this current time period. There's the running joke that he's never smoked a J before and he's too old to try one. but he loves music, so, like, it's, you know, constant balance of both. He's a great character. And the before figure of that's definitely, like, the Lyndon B. Johnson generation, and his entire viewpoint is, in terms of the magazine, forget the like subtle subtextual like sexism, is that he wants a report on the war. That's the most important thing to him. And so what this discussion he has with the man in charge of the newspaper is that, you know, basically we've printed the war 12 times, okay? The country's turned against the war. And, you know, I think the quote is, this marks another change in the counterculture movement. And, you know, maybe it's because I haven't visited this time period in a long time, and I definitely should have taken more history classes in college. But it's really fascinating. I know it was just one idea in this episode, but I would love to see that evolve over a new 10 episodes. You know, and again, this makes it more lensed of a series than Mad Men. And I believe one of my favorite descriptions of Mad Men is, again, we are just given a full range of people and just get to watch their lives happen. And their lives happen in such a compelling and fascinating way that it just keeps drawing us back, regardless of whether there's a massive driving force, you know, behind the entire series, which in my opinion, there never was. Like, The Mystery of Dawn got friggin' duped a really long time ago, and again, just became them living their lives, interacting with each other. Now what Good Girls does is I feel like this series is gonna ride the wave of cultural revolution, feminist change. I mean, it's called Good Girls Revolt. There's no way it can't. But it's not gonna shove it in your face. I like to think there will be moments that are like, wow, go feminism, when you're watching this series. But overall, at the end of the episode, you're like, Jesus, that was just great television. I don't feel like bogged down in heavy-handed issues and like now questioning my own moral base and how I view the world. No, but I mean, it leaves you thinking about it in like a very positive, light way. It also makes you, you know, want to friggin' put on vinyl, get high, and remember that this was a really awesome time period too. So, you know, that's my 2 cents, guys. I would love all of you to watch it because I want this show to get made. And there's definitely enough there for any age, any gender to enjoy this series. And if you like this time period, you don't, I mean, I hate you. It's great if you're a feminist. Fuck that. I won't even say that. It's great if you like this time period. It's great if you like good television, and it's great if you like coming away from a series, not just thinking about the show, but thinking about, fuck, the world, right? History, the greater context of what it is to, the greater context of what it is to be alive, and we'll end it there on that segment for Good Girls, because I don't want to get more topical than I just was. So, Good Girls Revolt, check it out on Amazon Prime, but along with that, The Leftovers has still been going on. It's funny, you know, with a lot of other shows, I expect all these, you know, breaks in the middle of season, but it hasn't happened yet for The Leftovers, thank God. As well as the Nick episode. So Leftovers episode 6, the Nick episode 4, and Fargo episode 6 all premiered over the last 4 days. I'm going to talk about Fargo a little bit, mostly because this past week was super good. They're all incredibly good. I enjoyed this last week because it was really violent, and I love violence. But with the last discussion brought up about Fargo, and this kind of also connects to the Nick, does not connect to The Leftovers, is somewhat that, you know, it was brought up, just it has bro appeal, I suppose. And I believe the second season has been struggling a little bit with ratings, and two great theories to that brought up on, one was the Vulture podcast, the other, you know, was personal thoughts, was that A, you know, there's less of the intrigue, like, oh, Fargo, I like that movie, maybe I'll watch the show, B, there's less of what we call the bro factor, and I know we just went about talking about Good Girls Revolt, but let's talk a little bit about the bro factor, and this is me, and this is best done through the lens of my friend Kevin. And a great example of this is House of Cards. Frank Underwood. Sorry, it's just it makes me laugh every time I think about this. Usually when a season of House of Cards comes out, the first when I was living with my friend Kevin, when I would come home and say, "Oh, dude, Steven, you gotta check this out. Frank is so tight. He's just like so crazy. Oh, that's just so tight. Like he's just doing awesome things." And if you get where I'm going with that is the bro appeal in this sense is that you're mirroring the character. You're fantasizing so hard about being able to do and being this person. Getting to Break Bad with Walter White was the example Vulture brought up. Frank Underwood is a personal example for people in my life. And I think the lens in Fargo season one for that was very much Billy Bob Thornton. I honestly I loved his character, but I honestly found the show more fascinating, mostly because of the setting and because of Molly, no, Molly Emmett, someone I went to school with. Molly Bluston? I'm sorry. The actress's name is Molly, but the character, was the female character of the series was the one I was compelled and drawn into. What's interesting about Fargo season two is it doesn't really have either of that. It doesn't have a lensed female character that we're following, and it doesn't introduce like a singular brotastic, perfect, like mirroring entity for like that excited, I want to be a badass male viewer, which could be contributing to lower ratings. I think my big thing is like, for people don't know this show is on. Like, they're advertising it well, but I think FX has some of the worst deals with Netflix, Hulu, etc. And more importantly, I think people just have really gotten into this mentality, and the Americans, oh my God, I'm forgetting names, guys. I'm sorry. The Americans head writer, talked about this on the Andy Greenwald podcast. He'll, because The Americans, another FX show, is one that is really good, one of my favorite series on television, yet it gets pretty abysmal ratings. And and one of the reasons I think is, and he said was, okay, so I go to the market, I run into someone in the street, they're like, oh my God, or at a dinner party, it's like, oh my God, The Americans is one of my favorite series. We just finished season two. We know season three is on, and we can't wait till it's up on Netflix. And for any reason, just like, yes, thank you for watching my show. I'd love to talk to you about it. But I mean, as I might, I'd have no stakes in, of that, the ratings factor, but I'm gonna watch it, and I hope it does well enough so it gets made. But as a as the producer, as a showrunner, they're like, fuck you, why aren't you watching it on TV? Why aren't you paying FX money so we get to keep making the show, But that's asking a lot. So a lot of great things to talk about on Fargo with when Nate comes on here, but I want to leave you with the elements of the setting is such a dynamic character. It is really subtle sometimes, but this what makes the show is that it's supposed to be in Luverne, Minnesota, and I think it's shot in like northern southern Canada somewhere, but and I also think like the True Detective creating like the Gothic South, not True Detective season two, which can burn in hell. It's such a foreign environment for me that I'm just I get lost in it. It's kind of like going to Narnia, except you're in freaking Luverne, Minnesota, or Fargo, North Dakota. It's a show that is self-aware in itself that it's created a giant sandbox of a world where its audience can enjoy itself and explore. Again, something that network television doesn't normally do. Creates a world and it puts you, on one of those track carts and you kind of look back and forth, but you enjoy the ride. Fargo is definitely one where it's like, nope, there's a sandbox and here's some tools. You'll see some stuff. Just be aware. So, watch the show, guys, please, because I don't want it to get canceled. Because HBO already said they're going to do True Detective season three. So, that was crap. And I know all of you were probably watching that. So please watch Fargo. It's on FX. If you have cable, but you don't, have DVR, you can watch it on Hulu. You can watch it on Amazon. You should be able to unlock it as long as you have your cable company password, etc. Moving on to The Leftovers. I need to read a few more reviews on this week, but it seems like critically everyone's been pretty on board that the series is a lot better now, and that this week has really stood out as a very strong episode. And I don't know if that to be true in my mind. I don't think any major truth bombs were dropped in the show. I think it's just more that this whole idea of the bird from the first episode was revealed, and honestly, it was more just a marker that the mystery has continued, and that we're all just now, maybe not we are, but the characters are more self-aware of it. Okay, so, you know, God, I'm so bad with actresses. She also is in Gone Girl, but the actress who plays Nora Durst on the series is constantly one of my favorite people on the series show to watch. Not because her, you know, her character is incredibly warm or loving or so. Her character just feels so lost. And, you know, when I watch the series, it's really easy to kind of get next to her and kind of just constantly just wonder what she's feeling. I don't want to say all the characters are doing that, because it's incredibly apparent for about 75% of the people. You know, you have the martyr, you know, Matt, you have Kevin, you know, the victim, we don't know. We have John Murphy, you know, the villain, allegedly, we don't know still. But there's something so special about Nora, that like she's somehow the key to unlocking the greater mystery. She's the key to understanding what it's like to live in, you know, this world that I wish I could say is post-apocalyptic, but it's not, because only less than 2% of the world's population disappeared. We're just living in this constant state of fear and uncertainty. Oh wait, I guess that's life in general. Okay, so the normal fear and uncertainty of life magnified times 1,000. Oh, and this episode just did that so perfectly. I need to watch Lost. I've said that on this podcast before, but what's great about the mystery of The Leftovers is, although it keeps building up and unraveling itself to the point where we still don't know what's going on and where we're going forward, it still manages to find a way to still get you to care. I know a lot of people in the season found that really just first season found that overwhelming and distracting, or maybe not distracting, just overwhelming and more so unnecessary. But it's been put to very good use in the second season, and you know, a great mystery. I thought we were going to get an answer to it this week, and instead we didn't. We just got another wild facet of this world, but almost that's why I want to watch it. Almost, you know, I kind of want the uncertainty to linger. I don't know what the show will be like when we get this more structured, destiny is the wrong word, but a clearer structure to the fate of these people. It hasn't appeared yet. I can't guess what's going to happen to who, where someone's going to end up, what someone's going to do, because every time they, you know, build, every time an episode builds upon itself or the previous episode upon information to give us more answers, it inserts something to completely defeat that point. This week's episode being, for example, based around the bird, but more importantly, when I first saw this season and the people bought Nora's house to do research on it, I literally was like, oh my God, we're gonna get, you know, a scientific, or what this world considers a scientific opinion of what happened. You know, that was not a driving force for me to watch the series, but it's something I was incredibly attached to and curious about. And this episode completely threw that out the window. I believe the quote was, "Ms. Drish, we believe you to be a lens." Also, I think that's why I've been saying that so much this episode. And she's like, "Oh, what does that mean?" It's like, well, the people around you disappear because of you, and chaos and discord follows you. She's like, "Yes, well, why is that?" And it's like, and you kind of, you hear like a slow pause build, and you're like, "Well, we believe you to be a vessel for the demonic presence of like a Gazriel or a Zazel or something, and this is why discord." And she just hangs up and starts laughing. And I hate saying the word meta, but what a meta moment for the audience. And that shit, they got us again. Oh, you know. So, David Lindelof, I've been with you the whole time, but I really, really, really appreciate the reevaluation of this series. And I really, really have been enjoying this season. So thank you so much for that. And we'll end the leftovers there. When we have a really, really good Kevin episode, I'll talk about the show a lot, because right now, I think for the average person who has to watch a ton of television, who doesn't watch a ton of television, has to pick and choose, the most compelling thing about this story is trying to figure is the relationship between Kevin Garvey, so Justin Theroux's character, and Anakin? The woman, who's the actress from Compliance, whose name is not Margot, who's playing Patty in this series, the dead member of the cult. His delusion is, and I think we're getting big reveals on that next season, because he just revealed it to Nora. So, big things happening on The Leftovers, and the Nick is just kind of moving along, as what I suspect. I probably need a little more time to process this episode, but again, if you know, with this whole Missoula strike thing going on, and you know, I'm just reading Facebook reports and like reports that there are death threats being put against these protesters, that's horrifying. And this episode again just had another great spit in the face of progressive America, and so. The main black character, Dr. Algernon, has a secret wife, which was revealed at the end of last episode. She's British, where in Europe we've been led to believe is a lot more progressive at this time. So, you know, obviously the Robertsons, who are, you know, Algernon's patron, his parents work for them, you know, and invite everyone in for a great dinner. Great dinner. And you know, he's just so grateful, everyone's so happy. It's like you wouldn't guess that anything is wrong, and then his wife goes, "You know, I'm really glad that all of you are so happy to have Algernon here in your life, but why aren't his parents up here? You know, if you love him so much, why aren't they up here eating at the table with us?" And he just goes, and everyone just gets that really awkward. I love white people, guys. I'm not racist against any of you, but like that awful, like, really guilty white person face. It's like, oh shit, like, oh, elephant in the room. And you know, Algernon just goes, "Because you know that's not how things are done here." And it's like, "Oh, well, I'm sorry, I just perhaps had a different idea of what progressive meant." And then the best part is at the end of that, the black maid comes in, looks Colonel Robertson in the face, and he's sitting at the head of the long table. So we get a direct POV shot from him directly at the maid, who going, "Mr. Robertson, sir, should I clear the table for dessert?" And we just get the complete reverse low angle up at his face, and it is the perfect look of white guilt in America. Oh, it's so great. I'll screenshot it and potentially post it with this episode. But the Nick nailed that right on the bat. And we only have a couple minutes left, so I'm going to leave it with, I'm impressed with the direction the show's giving its female characters. I'm honestly very surprised with The Room, both the writers as well as Steven Soderbergh have given, in general, all of the characters, including the side characters, for their own room to grow and expand. I definitely thought this show was going to be much more lensed around Clive Owen like last season. I'm sorry I'm using the word lens so much. So much more connected and involved around Clive Owen's narrative. And it's definitely branched in a way where every single character, Dr. Chickering, Birdie, you know, Dr. Gallinger, Algernon, you know, Jeremy Biggs' character, as well as Sister Harriet, you know, the ambulance driver Cleary, they all are getting such unique and individual plot lines. It's really, really impressive. Not to the point where you're going to kind of be stuck in the wiring aspect to figure out where everything... Sorry, the wiring is not a word. The wire, like, you know, David Simon's The Wire aspect of trying to unlock what the fuck is going on all the time. But there's a lot to keep track of. The most fascinating plot line from this episode is that the eugenics plot hole, as I said, the eugenics rabbit hole is continuing. Dr. Gallinger's character was mugged by a bunch of Italian immigrant children. And I believe the quote when he's talking to his former med school colleague about eugenics is like, I think he's like, what do they look like? Darker hair, dark eyed, you know, thicker complexion. It's like, incredibly different from the Italians you see from Florence and Milan. A completely different species. You know, and then he just pauses. You know, it's one thing for us to spread the word about this, but, you know, our way of life is being threatened, and you can see where this discussion is going. And it basically leads to a conversation about sterilization of minorities and people you feel othered against. I don't know. The show's great. Watch it. No, that's not, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, every time I get caught up on these topical issues, I just wonder how much you need to actually hear about it and how much I want you to experience it by watching the series. But more so, the Nick is remaining relevant. I think the showrunner, as well as Steven Soderbergh, the director, who I'm not going to call the showrunner, are very, very crafty and self-aware filmmakers, in the sense that they were very easily, in my opinion, able to solve a lot of the issues with the first season revolving around making the female characters a little... Interesting is the wrong word. A little less traditional. Giving them a little more content, as well as making the show not just about an Aryan white male. And season 2 has delivered all of those promises. But okay, I don't know if that was planned or not. Because, you know, if season 1 is arguably about the fall of an Aryan white male, and season 2 is kind of about his recovery, but it's more about, you know, his world as we've moved on since that. And I don't know. This season is a lot easier to watch. But, yeah, I'm losing some steam here, guys. Hopefully I will get that Fargo discussion on tape by the end of the week or at the beginning of next week. Things to look out for. If you're a huge anime fan and you like shonen a lot, Netflix just helped produce the Nanatsu no Taizai, or The Seven Deadly Sins, which is up on Netflix. The first 24 episodes of the manga are on there. Really entertaining, kind of like Final Fantasy. It's true shonen, so if you're like a huge fan of like Death Note, like Parasite the Maxim, don't watch this show. But if you want something light and adventurous, check it out. Really looking forward to AKA Jessica Jones coming out in 9 days, as well as if you have time this Sunday. I thought it was coming out last Sunday, I apologize. Check out AMC's new Into the Badlands, another post-apocalyptic bro show. But I'm more really interested in it because Asian leading characters. I know it's stupid that I should look out for those things, but I get really excited about that. So there's that to look forward to. If you need to get some Star Wars anxiety out of the way, check out Star Wars Rebels on Disney XD. You can probably find a lot of the episodes online. It's really nice. It's kind of like Firefly meets Star Wars. It's not as heavily structured as the Clone Wars. And actually, if you're also a Clone Wars fan, this season they've integrated the Wolf Pack and Anakin's Padawan Ahsoka Tano back into the fold. So it's awesome. I need my Star Wars fix, you know, every day. So this helps. But since this is another 45 minutes of droll, me getting way too topical and rambling a lot, thanks again for listening to this episode, guys. Remember, The Nick is on every Friday, The Leftovers is on every Sunday, and Fargo is on every Monday. And Good Girls Revolt is up on Amazon Prime. Thank you for listening to Storytime with Tofu. Hope you all have a great day or night. Bye.